supposed to be the fun part of the day, right, where we discuss and turn over to the dirty and dark side, right, and discuss all our hidden questions. What we want to do is we want to start with membrane proteins earlier on and then fill in a few questions, one or two that I have gotten, or general questions that are still left over. You know, if you think back, I mean, the fun scales, right, with your participation. The more you participate, the more fun it's actually going to be. And it's okay to be controversial, right? So we don't have to be all peacefully smiling all the time. But what I wanted to do is, if you think about what happened this week, you know, the challenges are actually increasing as we go through the week. So on Monday, we have been dealing with single particle, which, you know, Joachim in his lecture summarized in a single word where the state of single particles is, and that was panic. Right? Then on Tuesday, we were talking about the tomography, which sort of was summarized by Bob involuntarily, right, during the discussion section as shortcut to coma. Let's see what today brings, right? And so now talking about why is the challenge for the membrane protein so big, you know, and to just put that in perspective, because none of the speakers really said that, because it sounds always a little whiny. Why is that the challenge for the membrane protein so big, or bigger than for many other things, is that we have this several layers of complexity we have to express, purify, crystallize, or do single particle. And what they didn't say is, what are the time frames for these things? Now, if we think about the expression, the best time frame is a couple of weeks, right, for expression. The worst time case is infinity, right? It may just simply not express, and that is particularly true for mammalian proteins, and I hope that Ray can fill us in on some of the exciting advantages here. Purification, well, that can be days. And you can guess what comes here. So that can be infinity. It may just not purify. You may not be able to find a detergent that will stabilize your protein adequately. Crystallization, well, this can go from hours to infinity, right? So if you're a graduate student thinking about a membrane protein project, then you come up with the most likely time frame, which is basically just infinity cubed. Also explains why this doesn't make sense to solve just one problem. Let's say we solve the expression. Well, that reduces our problem to infinity squared, right? So in other words, what the problem is with the membrane protein is that while we need advance in every single one of the categories, every single point of handling, it will not really do all that much if it comes at the right, at the wrong time, right? We need really all these things come together. So my suggestion would be to take, let's say, all the people that have switched doing tomography and all apply them to solving the problems in 2D crystallography. And 5 years from now, everybody will be doing 2D crystallography, right? Because the problems have been solved simply because somebody got so annoyed about, you know, being troubled and pained all the time that they sort out the problem that's there. But as we've heard this morning, with 10 labs or so left on the planet that are dealing with these things actively, that's just a very tall order. Now, if we talk about this, Ray, do you want to comment a little bit on where you're standing with expressing particularly mammalian membrane proteins? Because that is where, you know, in the long run, I think it has to go.
So, again, I'll make a lot of analogies. I made analogies this morning towards NMR and X-ray crystallography that sort of come together. And part of it was because we realized we're making the same samples. Well, it's actually the same exact thing for EM. We make the same exact samples. We try to make the most stable construct, most stable form of the protein, and stabilize it with ligands or anything else. So all three areas, NMR, crystallography, EM, all does the same thing in the first step. I think expression-wise, you know, either the work that, you know, our approach is actually more ligand stabilization. We use high-throughput screening to try to find small molecules that just stabilize these proteins so we can actually do purification. I don't think purification is actually, I wouldn't even put infinity there. It's very, I don't want to say straightforward, but it's more routine now in terms of purification. The biggest challenge is just on expression. And so the work that we do is stabilization, the work that's being done at the MRC by Chris Tate and others, you know, trying to stabilize these things through mutations, Brian Kibolka with T4 lysozyme. It's all about trying to find a stable construct. So the most of the work is nowadays at the very earliest stage, expression. And then purification is straightforward. Crystallization is always, you never know exactly when. But if you have the right construct, you do the right, we spend more time now, this might be a bit of a tangent, so I apologize for that, but you know, we spend more time doing biophysical analysis, thermal stability screening. We look very carefully at, you know, size exclusion, the actual shape of the peaks. We spend a huge amount of time just analyzing the protein sample and all the constructs. So when we get to the stage of crystallization, for us, 3D crystallization, we've pretty much optimized most everything, and we think we're in good shape to be successful on the latter half. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but I think expression, no?
Yeah, so the expression, you know, for me, the major question is really, okay, so if you want to really look like, say, at mammalian membrane protein, and, you know, the beta adrenergic receptors and the GPCR is obviously one of the things that has started moving over the past 2 or 3 years or so, but that is just one family out of many others. So how do we get the quantity? Is there any magic, what in your experience as these centers come together, right? Is there early trends, some things that do work, some things that definitely don't work?
But you said something right at the very beginning, which I completely agree with, is it's not one breakthrough, it's breakthroughs in all the different steps. And so it's not just an expression problem. I mean, one of our focuses from 9-10 years ago was in miniaturization. You know, we had this idea that if we go down to nanoliter volumes, then we would have more material. The reason we did it was actually membrane proteins. It's just hard to make these samples. Well, nanoliter volume crystallization, you know, is now relatively routine. Everybody's doing it. So we don't need as much material. So therefore, on expression, it's easier. You talked, you know, you're asking the specific question about mammalian membrane proteins, and this is also, you know, where I think the biggest challenge is. I'd like to see some real ion channel membrane, you know, some real, I'd like to see a human ion channel structure and see what the differences are compared to bacterial. You know, we now have some rat structures and stuff. But I think that's where the sort of focus needs to be. But we have great expression technologies. I mean, beta 2 is a good example. Beta 2 is expressed at really high levels. You know, I went to Bob Lefkowitz's lab in 1992, you know, 17 years ago, to learn how to express it. So expression has never been, I think, the problem. It's finding a stable construct. It's miniaturizing the other techniques, whether it's purification or biophysical characterization. It's using multiple tools to analyze your samples before you get into crystallization. I think crystallization is a black box. It has been. We pray. We put our protein into trials, at least, you know, I know you're mainly in 2D area, but in 3D, it's, you know, really is a sort of black box area. We sort of, you know, hope we're going to get something. Now, one of the things actually Vadim, you know, has been doing for the last couple years is we now switched over to lipidic cubic phase, because we believe to get into a more membrane-like environment, we wanted to get away from detergents. We actually agree with, you know, what David and Nigel said this morning about detergent environments. So we went into LCP. Vadim's been developing tools so he can measure diffusion in LCP. So we actually watch the proteins diffuse and know whether or not the proteins can nucleate, studying stability in LCP, studying activity in LCP, and so trying to create new platforms in a environment, all done at the, you know, very low nanoliter scale. So it's all the different techniques, miniaturizing and trying to increase expression, combining all of them together. So, but membrane protein, mammalian membrane proteins, I don't think it's, expression is not the problem. Finding the right construct, I think that's the problem. Finding the right ligand that stabilizes it. You know, for us, finding cholesterol that stabilizes it, that was, you know, I think that's one of the biggest challenges. So when we approach a new GPCR, that's the hard part, is finding, you know, those right parameters.
Am I supposed to beat the ball? That's a novel. Okay, so while the next person is speaking, I will study your Joachim's question. Let's see if I can shorten it down to the So, you know, Liz, you brought up this point about lipids, you know, how physiological. So do any of you have any, what would you trust more? Let's do a vote. What would you trust more? A membrane protein structure that's soft and detergent or something that's soft and lipid?
So you're advocating. Yeah, you know, but yeah, I could still be worried about whether it rains in San Diego tomorrow. So the question is, you know, this is a valid concern, but what are we going to do about it?
Is there anything we can? Question a little bit differently, which is, I think we all agree, perfect world, you have EM high resolution EM structure in its native environment. That's what everybody wants. We really like to have it. But that's not realistic. So, you know, because you know, I was watching, so I was thinking while Nigel was talking, I mean, yeah, what a tour de force in terms of, you know, all that sort of work. It's a huge amount of work. This law is really easy. You know, we try to, you know, once we get our diffraction, you know, we get these great tools that allow us to go quite quickly. But we are in an artificial environment. Even this is same issues all the time. Now, what I would actually ask the question this way: what information can we get from EM that'll confirm the X-ray structures? Not even just EM people saying, "Well, I don't want to be your, you know, confirmatory tool." Well, Kurt Ulrich now believes NMR's best place for NMR is actually just in confirming some of the X-ray stuff and providing the dynamics. So, Kurt. So, you know, I think, you know, EM, I think the great place is we want to understand what it's like in its real world environment, natural environment. How can we collect that information without having to have a, you know, long tour de force collection of information? And I don't know. I'm actually curious what the idea is. What's the information that you can collect that would help confirm the X-ray structures in the most efficient way possible? Along with it.
Well, it still needs a crystal, though, that would diffract to those resolutions. Alan.
Yeah. Oh, and I think this is absolutely correct. I mean, one of the things that we're interested in is complexes. We want to start putting together X-ray crystallography. You know, we can't, there's some things that we just, it's beyond our ability. Yeah, we can be on it for a long time. EM is better at understanding those complexes and then resolve the little pieces that then go in. But EM. Put the pieces of the puzzle together in the right orientation. I used to actually sort of give this talk where, you know, if you let an X-ray crystallographer put together, I think it was actually, I used this as a sort of line zone example. If you let a crystallographer without, you know, solving all the separate pieces before the full structure is known, let him put all those pieces together, can you imagine the different, you know, sort of 3D artist that has all the abstract? You know, you get a lot of different shapes. So don't leave it up to.
Well, Fred, would you want to comment on this?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, there's two issues. So one is, you clearly might be better than the next, sort of, the secondary stuff. The other issue is, this whole idea of using your EM map to explain the dynamic situation, which then can give you a atomic model. I don't know what your experience is with the use of EM.
I was thinking, in Fred's case, for example, if you think about this idea of putting things into liposomes and then subtracting, looking at things like the pedal. Is the pedal up? Is it down? Where is it? What is the orientation? So for that, to order that ultimately, you will need a bilayer somewhere there. And I think your approach is because you say, well, with the liposomes you can impose potentials, you can impose voltages, and can actually look at it at really low resolution presumably, but the answer is not requiring atomic resolution to start with. I think that brings us back to one of the things is when we're always bitching about our resolutions, and I'm still amazed that some people have slides up here where the resolution has a second significant digit, right? Because I look at the structure and say, well, does it tell the story or doesn't it? If it doesn't tell, then the digits are somewhat, sort of, yeah.
Very significant.
Yeah? That's the one. Are there any other questions? Concerning to the talk, we have one or two questions here. In fact, I will not reveal which ones you are asking, so I have to decide to randomize. We'll randomize so that people cannot go back and collect answers. Do we have any questions that were left over from this morning?
Something that we mentioned when we wrote up this idea, but it's clearly a direction.
Steve looked at a rather paper some years ago where he was trying to combine the information
access to it.
And I've never heard any more from them. That seems to be another kind of
idea. You could, with a fast camera, you could change the focus as you acquire the image. The zeros would move through the image, and you could correct, you have no zeros in the CTF, the same molecule. Of course, the later defocus images would be at higher cumulative dose, so they wouldn't be as good. But I think there are lots of possibilities that become realistic.
This is bizarre.
I think they were doing that this morning, you know, they got a single particle difference or something like that.
Complicated CPM determination, right? Adding all the terms, EM, we're going to use single molecule Western spectroscopy. And so we're doing an experiment over the next year. We're actually doing both. And you know, there's pros and cons. Now, I'm curious from the audience, would anybody be supportive of
to do what? Like what can you do single molecule?
We can actually look at it. So we can't get the deep, say, you know, natural sort of responses. No, we're not going to get the detailed interaction. We're not going to be able to see that picture. Although I'm not sure we're going to see that picture because we've been trying to use EM. Well, we're hoping to see sort of complexes, the rest and things like that. But with single molecule fluorescence, thus we start to, you know, we can answer both dynamic type of questions, we're curious about time scales, and then also by labeling locations, we can start to get some orientations. And then with modeling, try to fill it in dynamics, you know, to work with the exactly right. Well, we have structures. I mean, the nice thing about the sort of GPCR field is we now have structures of GPCRs, B proteins, arrestin, even GRK.
These are
X-ray structures, you're right. Yeah. So, but, and again, you know, perfect world, you're right. We do both. We're sort of doing the experiments, but both in parallel. But I'm just curious to sort of thoughts on this group. Because it addresses the question, where can you use EM towards membrane proteins? Or are there other techniques? Want to talk about real environment type of conditions, shoot a single molecule of fluorescent spectroscopy, you can get some really good information as well. And I think they're complementary personally. Just curious to your thoughts.
Well, it's going to depend hugely on how big the problem is. It's all of it.
And that's a challenge.
But you know, since the question there would be, is that really true? You know, I think, I mean, to me, it's so clearly, but you know, the whole thing with membrane protein structure, this is now at the critical point. You know, 10 years from now, we will be all done with this, and this is a thing of the past. Okay. Next challenge will really be going after the complexes, right? And I think there, EM does have the unique advantage that you can create complexes in a membrane environment, right? And then you take the picture and worry later what to do with this, right? And how to analyze it. So for example, if your potassium channel were to make a complex with something interesting that is not necessarily embedded in the bilayer, what would be wrong with, you know, reconstituting that in your Visigoths, subtracting Visigoths into a single particle reconstruction on that, where you don't have any worries about detergent. So I think that is something where, you know, I definitely would think that if you want to go after a resin or whatnot, why not try this nanodisc thing that you just reconstitute that with a nanodisc and then see if you can either subtract that out and get rid of it. Right?
Well, I would say that the first thing you're going to have to do is to find some way to stabilize this neural transient interaction. Right? So you're going to be doing some expression screening or complex formation screening using split GFP or something like that to stabilize this. And once you established constructs that give you a stable complex, then you could try the nanodisc sort of a lipid bilayer, and it's going to be probably too small, but you could try 2D crystallization as well at that point. And the formation of 2D crystals in this dye or is quite sensitive, and I think much easier than 3D crystallization. Stable protein, probably, in my information, set up one low resolution fractal crystals, which is all you need.
The reason we even went into this with the single molecule. We don't know. You say it's transient, other people say it's stable. We have no idea. I don't know the answer whether GPCR can put in interaction. I asked 10 people with full answers. So, you know, we wanted to try to address that question first. And then once we address it, then could we find conditions, completely right, find the conditions that would stabilize it. And then would we bring that back to EM once we figured out the conditions to stabilize it? Or where are we going?
About the 2D crystallization, I disagree with you. Know, I think it's the same thing as with 3D crystals. You know, your protein either likes to crystallize, and then it will be so even if you don't try. And if it doesn't, you know, then you can generate 150,000 mutants trying to stabilize it and see if it behaves better. And the mutant that does is physiologically dead.
No idea how quickly they can screen different expression constructs. So we'll do 150 other ones and we'll find one that does like it.
Right, but eventually you run out of those, and you know, you're left with the ones that you actually want to know that pop into port through your screen. Okay, so once you, you know, so the whole thing with the genomics thing, with the genomics initiative, is really going for the low-hanging fruit. You know, the old things that just are can be impressed by muscle flexing and loud noises and chest beating.
I'll actually disagree with you. Yeah? I think they can use the same exact tools. You know, as David said, the MRC really wanted the GPC hair structure. We needed, right? Well, what did we do? We didn't, you know, go and look for low-hanging fruit to adopt what was already done. You know, the MRC, they mutated very systematically, beautiful science, looked at it, and found thermal stabilized versions. And then once they sort of understood that, then they could put that in, and that worked. So I think you can use these same tools to either what we call a sort of, you know, we can screen through, or we can do a very focused, you know, analysis around one target. I think these same tools can be used for either approach, and you're right. You can make a huge number of constructs, run them in parallel, and find ones, and on that one protein you're interested in.
Yeah, I could say, I think in terms of EM and membrane proteins, I think there's kind of two directions. One of them is that if you're particularly keen to have your particular membrane structure now, can't say we're going to develop methods that are going to work out in 5 years' time with better detectors, CD correctors, big plates, and so on. You have to say, what are the techniques now? If you want high resolution for proteins between 50 kilodaltons and 250 kilodaltons, they are a bit small for doing it without crystallons. So therefore, you have to make a crystal.
Yeah.
And then that crystal can be either a 3D crystal, again, maybe a lipid phase or a detergent phase, a variety of methods, or you have a 2D. Or you can make one-dimensional helices or icosahedra, which is sort of what the viruses are, some of them are membrane viruses. So you have, on the one hand, a variety of ways of making crystals, 1D, 2D, you know, high symmetry point groups, 3D, X-ray, EM, and then it doesn't really matter too much whether it's X-ray or EM that you're doing, and it can be diffraction. You do have an advantage in EM, that you have images, you have phases, but the power of X-ray and all these structures in the database now probably means that no GPCR crystal structure in the future will ever need phases. You do it by molecular replacement. Maybe the same will be true of the child. And then the other side of it is the development of our field to make it better in terms of signal to noise. And that is the single particle area, which might be one molecule or a little tetramer and so on. And there are lots of technical problems, and it's going to be 2, 3, 4, 5 years. But I think this meeting gives us a very good feeling for what's happening and who's interested in doing particular things. So I think, you know, there is a valid and productive future in either direction, depending on whether you're mainly interested in empowering methods so you can do smaller things and cover a much bigger range, which could include small G-protein coupled receptor complexes, or smaller ion channels and so on, or whether you want to do your best now with the methods. So I mean, that's the kind of feeling I get based on the
But you know, I think as you improve the technology, there will be new questions that we even don't think about now because it just say it's ridiculous. Another one. Okay. Any follow-up? Otherwise, I dive into what I have. Right. So this goes also back. I think it was John's talk. The density of vitreous water. Right. So here it says was originally determined using polystyrene beads, which was found to be not ideal at all because they're soft. And has that value been confirmed by an independent method? Anybody knows what the answer is? So, is the density of vitrified water actually being ever confirmed by different?
Yeah. So my question was because in Jack Bush's lab, you know, tried to use this transparent beat for finding the density of hydrogen for frozen and it was not working at all. The explanation is because when you cut them, they compress
So I think the answer is no, it has not been.
I'm trying to remember how the coding experiments were done. I seem to remember that they weren't done on vitreous ice that's prepared and we prepare it. Were they neutron scanning experiments? Or?
I think it was.
Vitreous ice produced in another way. It's easy on how that is. I don't think it's done by a cosmic, but like a chef who has done measurements. It's so important to precisely know as long as you know what's more dense than what.
Well, when people do simulation for a subtractive system, density, this was, well, okay, you can find these parameters, or your position, but in some cases, it's really
shows that with 1 to 2 electrons per square angstrom of the radiation, the electron refraction pattern of ice completely changes. And it's not clear what that means. Some people say that it indicates the density of ice has gone up from 0.90 or 0.92 up to 1.1. I think that cannot be true, it turns out. I think it has a different explanation, but it's kind of controversial. And that's an area no one's working on. So I think all of the ices that I know, they're all supposed to be 0.90, 0.92, 0.94, hexagonal, cubic, amorphous. They're all low. And then there is this kind of rumorish, published, of course, as well, that it gets dense, when you irradiate it at the helium temperature. But if it goes from 0.9 to 1.1, and you've got 1,000 angstroms of ice, it should then be 800 angstroms of ice. So you ought to be able to put spherical gold beads on the surface, measure the distance apart, and see it going down. And no one's ever observed that, so I have to say, I don't think the ice changes density very much until you irradiate it. And my favorite explanation is that oxygen is produced, hydrogen has evolved at a helium temperature, and it's the oxygen that makes it denser and makes your contrast fade. And so what we need is people to be measuring hydrogen and oxygen evolution as you irradiate it in the microscope with a mass spec. I think we've managed to take the helium to do that.
Any volunteers? Shall we pick one? Just one from this one. Huh?
Okay.
Sarah? Okay, here's another question that goes to Nigel, actually. The question was that earlier models of the structural models of the acid calling that suggested this iris mechanism, similar to gap junctions, sort of putting. And that with the higher resolution now, it seems to be that the picture that emerges is quite different. So the question there is then, should one ever make a mechanistic model from a low resolution map or just dip one's mouse and keep shut until we have crystal structures that will actually show the chemistry at the atomic level? If you will, yes.
We try to look at the I think we learned some quite important things that one was that the outer helix is different. Another was the channel seemed to open up in the middle. But we did think that the helix is open up by a
well, never, you know, I will retire before I get five years or something. But that's, I agree. You know, my feeling is that some of the limitations I feel that are sometimes there with the EM people is that we are very proud of the structures we produce, but there is very few of us who actually have the tenacity and do anything biologically or physiologically relevant, you know, like in vivo testing or making lots of mutants to check animistic, mechanistic models. So, you know, if you come up with a mechanistic model, it should make predictions, and those predictions should be testable. And then you can go out and you can test, and if it doesn't hold up, well, then obviously something is wrong with the model. If you get so answers that seem to be within the error or noise level of your expectation value, then I think it's perfectly valid to just go out and say, that's what it is right now, and if it changes tomorrow, well, then we'll have better data to support it. So that's, I think that is good. Otherwise, there's no fun in all of it. Which doesn't mean you should just publish everything you get, okay? I mean, that is also not perfect. Let's actually do an experiment. How many of us have gotten something wrong in that? That is mostly for the younger people to see. Right?
We all stand up in the name, guys.
Let's do the reverse experiment. Is there anyone in the audience who think they always get it right? See, that's an encouraging start. Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. Study such issue too.
Studying would actually be sort of doing all these results somehow. I mean, that's a very nice aura.
So you mean you're doing a study to see, you know, what the trial and
error. Well, I mean, I think there's some examples of going back to some papers that there are, for instance, I just tell you now what coach all the lessons that have
any more thoughts on it? No, you know, I think what you're actually saying is that you said, well, you know, we always try to brush our less glorious moments under the carpet, you know, and that there could very well be valuable things. So there are things where people say, well, they see certain things and they jump to certain conclusions, that happens more than once. You know, if it happens 20 times and there seems to be something significant there, that probably has to do with human psychology, how we interpret and we need to understand what we're doing wrong in it. So I don't disagree with that. You know, I think you can learn from your mistakes if you share them. Well, just because other people don't do it doesn't mean that you can't. Well, you know, since you are master, well, you know, so I think it should be somebody who is used to working with very large databases. That's all I'm saying. So and that only leaves about one or two labs in the nation. And so that could, no. So here's another question, actually. Did anyone try to make fusion constructs with something that is not, you know, basically, can you do lattice engineering? So can you use two-dimensional lattice as a template for dragging whatever along and get a structure, not by single particle approaches, but by crystallographic approaches, so you take the guesswork out and you know that what you get is sort of right. Like, because in crystallography you know what you're doing, okay? So I mean, you see your data and there's clear criteria what to deal with them. Anyone wants to comment on it before I continue on that?
There is one experiment that I have, I can't remember how I learned about it, but Martin Noble, who is a completely rigorous dyed-in-the-wool X-ray crystallographer from Oxford, has been interested in this idea of creating a matrix to which you can attach other things. And they started a tiny little company. I don't remember the name of the company, but if you knew Martin Noble, 2D crystal lattice, and so on, I'm sure it will pop up in one of the search engines. And I don't know what the molecule is, but it has a pretty picture, negatively stained lattice, a couple of angstroms, completely square, so it must be a tetramer connected together by a dimer, where the tetramers bind to the dimer, as a monolayer. And then the idea is used, you know, so there are people thinking about 1D, 2D, and so on, creating matrices to attach them. And that was just one example of it.
I said this last time, 2 years ago, you know, the ideal thing you want to have is you want to have one version, you know, future 15th or 50th generation version of the API grids that are now in this middle layer, where you basically say you take a cell, you bust it up, you dunk your grid, and then you go have a pot of coffee in the cellar, but you come back, put it out, freeze it, and you have a 3x3 millimeter two-dimensional crystal, or whatever you want to look at, right? And then you spend one day collecting data, you know, one day of number crunching on a small workstation, and you get a 5-dimensional structure. That's, you know, where it should go, I think, in principle, and I think it's all totally possible, but we need to find the nobles somewhere. You have done something with your lipitures. Yeah, I know. I understand, but you know, so the thing that always bugs me and gets me worked up, as you can tell, is that people are so negative. Okay?
I'm not being negative, but I try.
You know, you have to
have support for it. There's no much support for doing that.
Okay. Well, you know, then we have to lobby. Right?
Can I ask a question about that T4 lysosome? So I think what Liz was alluding to is that the linker is very important. If you've got a flexible linker and a rigid strep avid and 2D crystal, your flexible linker kills you. So did they work on this?
Yes, so I'll give you, I think this is related to your question coming up.
have some experiences with it. If it works, it's great. If it doesn't work, it's well, not so great. No, but yeah, so it really support is the issue that we all have with NIH sort of going on. So the question is whether it would make a difference if one gains up and basically makes a larger group. Because, you know, for me, one of the problems that we use something like this is that you say there's one person with one graduate student, one postdoc, maybe a technician, and they want to take on the world in 3.5 years. And that is bound to fail. But if there were 20 people that say, we as a group have determined that is what needs to be done, and you will give us the money. Right? We've decided you will give us the money. And then you just go there and just, German tongue, you just roll over them. And, you know. Yeah. Well.
Now that there's a number of RH structures of icosahedral viruses, good case could be made. You don't have to take a fusion protein or a fusion crystal, make it the spikes of an icosahedral virus. And of course, the Tila Ventra, they can go put in a heroic effort and eventually it will crash. But the reason that Ray mentioned that you have to get the connector right. And she found the sweet spot between too tight and too loose doesn't exist. One to the other. Doesn't mean it's going to happen for everything, so you know, maybe we try it some more. I'm reminded of the difficulties that aberration corrector labs have in succeeding to correct aberrations. And then it was decided, you know, it doesn't work. Nobody can make it work, therefore don't fund it. And the field languished for a long time because it didn't have support. Once you've got it, it's great. So I an idea that should continue to be supported.
I'm just wondering, in the States, the problem of icosahedral virus is that the temperature test is not important. So maybe what we should be doing is following up on this whole project and using some beautiful things. And, you know,
you know, there were EM workshop contests like for particle printing programs. Why don't we have a contest on, you know, who can make it for these fields? Right? Something like that, you know. So I think the answer is that there has to be a group consensus. We want this done, and then it gets done. But if people always say, oh, that's too difficult, that can't be cleared, of course it won't happen, right? And if people struggle on their own, that kills the momentum. So that is the question, you know, can we as a field prioritize what really the issues are and where we need action? And then really come together and forget our political little hiccups and, you know, whatever, right? And just get it done because we're interested in solving the problem, you know, rather than closing company, you know, so that's irrelevant. Well, but you know, there may be an off chance, okay, that this is actually working for your project and you get data and you get that funded, right? I mean, so that's, you know, I mean, if somebody puts in the sweat and the effort into coming up with some ideas or so, it's easy enough to ship that idea out and have that just tried in 20 different labs and have 20 different labs each try 3 days or a week. Let's be generous, a week, okay? That's not really a lot of effort, but if 50 labs were trying this for a week and it comes back with 10 hits, then this can go on funded and do the next generation of these templates to try learn from what was successful, what didn't work. But you know, I think it's just our lazy ass mentality that we say, oh, you know, this is not for myself, and you know, blah. there is one more question, actually, and then we should go into the process session after that. So here's a more general question about antibody labeling strategies. Which approach works best? So who is doing antibody labeling? Yeah? It doesn't say. It's one of these great questions where you can say anything and it answers it. Right? Which approach works best?
So I'm just like say I've had very little success with antibody labeling, but if you are working with a genetically tractable system, it's quite easy to introduce a label. Well, because your molecule isn't essential in introducing a big blob like GFP or multiple spiking protein or something. We've done a lot. It's about attenuation signal that stick a happening on. And that's actually a very straightforward, high stereo.
So what is the latest gossip about antibody, making antibodies against, you know, native 3D epitopes crystallized? Is that gaining more traction, or is that still
off? No, so we actually decided, so we were pretty close to the Wattis lab.
Even smaller, so that's good. So, are we post a session now? Or
are we post a session?